This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Seeing restrictions at the base in terms of the men's conditions, things that cumulatively were different from the way things had been years before and that were just making life even more difficult for people who have already been detained for 11 years. So there was a certain kind of lead-up in terms of harsher restrictions, but the trigger point seemed to be searches of the men's Qurans, which they viewed as an act of religious desecration. That should not have been news to the authorities. As you said, there have been protests and strikes in Guantanamo before. Many of them were triggered by acts of religious abuse. There is a history of religious abuse at the prison. In the early years, there were acts like guards throwing the Qurans on the floor, stepping on them, shaving the men's beards as punishment, removing their pants to prevent them from praying. So that's the background here, and it should have been known that an act like searching the Qurans would have been a very serious provocation, and that's literally what seemed to have triggered the strike. We, the attorneys of people still there, have been hearing consistently since February 6th that most of the men at the prison have been on strike. Those reports, the numbers have been disputed by the military. At the beginning, they were saying there were no more than five or six people on hunger strike. There was a complete defense of their actions in terms of searching the Qurans and what led to this all. At this point, even the military is acknowledging that there are over 40 people on strike. There are 11 people, they're saying, being tube-fed. But, you know, the bottom line is actually the numbers don't matter. It doesn't matter if there are, you know, if most of the men right now are on strike or if, you know, it's the numbers that the military is saying. The point, the background here and what really shouldn't be lost despite the specific trigger is the broader emergency at Guantanamo that's been going on for years, and that is the indefinite detention of people who have already been held for over 11 years without charge, who will never be charged, and most of whom, over half of whom, have been approved to leave by the Obama administration itself. So that is the broader disaster.
Absolutely. The thought of being locked up and never knowing if you're going to see family members again. I mean, I've even read accounts where, you know, the men wonder, should they tell their wife, leave me? You know, turn your back on us, find a way to survive, find a new husband because I'll never be free.
Right.
Or tell their families, forget about me, don't think about me because you won't be able to see me and you don't want to know what's happening to me. That's a pretty desperate psychological place to be in.
Right. And, you know, we've had clients who have, you know, had family members pass, had children born, you know, over a decade is a long time. And they have, since 2009, you know, they were told this would be the end. President Obama came in on his second day in office. He signed an executive order promising very strongly to close the prison. He had a line of military, former military officers and retired generals standing behind him, supporting him. There was a great deal of hope at the time. I remember going down to the base and meeting with clients there and saying, you know, I know we've said this before, you know, I know you've been holding on for a long time, but this time it really does seem to be different. We've got a president who's made this promise, who thinks Guantanamo is wrong, thinks it's immoral, thinks it's unlawful, thinks that it's against U.S. national security. So hold on. And they did. You know, some of them were transferred. I have two clients, actually three, who were transferred in, you know, the early days of 2009 when there was a great deal of momentum, a lot of hope, a lot of support from other countries to resettle people who can't return to their home countries. But over the past, you know, 3 years, 4 years, what's happened is that opponents to the closure of Guantanamo have, you know, they have responded, and in Congress they have passed restrictions that make transfers very difficult. And President Obama has not responded in kind. He has not stood up and exercised the kind of leadership that's needed here and, you know, stood for his promise and created a plan to really move forward and fully implement it. And
Pardis,
you know,
can I ask you if, in fact, it hasn't been a little bit the opposite way? I think that I recall maybe it was over, it was definitely probably over a year ago, but there was a little bit of a change, they were saying, in Guantanamo. Things had eased. Men were being allowed to pray in groups. They were being allowed to be in groups more often, not kept in solitary as much, etc. And then there's this change that began to take place that you're talking about, that the men started reporting. It seems to me that that change coincided with a sort of open giving, you know, I mean, he doesn't say it, but a giving up on Guantanamo and turning it over to the officials. Because wasn't there also an attempt to pass a an attempt to make it more difficult for attorneys to get to see their clients on Guantanamo? Wasn't that in the last year, and you guys fought that off?
Well, right. So in the past, you know, I wouldn't even say past year, in the past few months, there have been changes. And I was saying, you know, it was in the background here leading up to this particular strike. There are new authorities. There's a new commander down at the base right now. There are new people in charge. And these harsher practices have coincided with new people being brought in.
Okay.
You know, the motivation for the changes, we don't know. But there has been, you know, they've coincided. As you said, access to the base has also, for attorneys, been made more difficult. The way we usually get down, many of us, is we take commercial flights to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and then we've taken charter planes to the base. And it's a very long trip, but that's how we've gotten down. And what the military had done was canceled the operators, the non-military commercial operators that fly from Fort Lauderdale to the base, eliminating a very important route for us.
Yeah, yes.
The only way, you know, without those commercial carriers, the non-military options are the military options, which are fine, but, you know, it's within the discretion of the military to approve seats on those flights. It's within the discretion of the military to determine when those flights take off. If they take off, they're not reliable. And for a period of time, that was the only option we had. And so it was extremely worrying because this also happened while the strike was taking place, when access and contact and communication was so critical. At this point, they've resumed the commercial flights. It still doesn't mean it's easy to get down there, but that option is still there. But I, you know, just separate from the specific triggers and the harsher restrictions, this is not surprising. The fabric here in the background here is the increasing frustration, the increasing desperation, anxiety of people who've been held for this long and still don't know when they're going home. So, you know, the conditions at the base right now are harsh. They're difficult. They've made life difficult. They're provocations on their own, but what's going on is very much connected to the fact of indefinite and continuing detention.
You know, Pardis, I'm speaking, this is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KBOO, and I'm speaking with Pardis Cabrillai of the Center for Constitutional Rights. It seems to me like this is a perfect time. You know, here at KBOO, we're volunteer program hosts, and we wear a lot of hats, and sometimes I'm an investigative journalist, sometimes I'm just a program host, and almost always in the background, I'm an activist. As an activist, I don't distort the facts when I'm a journalist or in any way do that, but I definitely have a point of view, and today I have a point of view, which is I want you all out there in the audience to take action today. So I'm asking you to get a pencil or a pen somewhere, or if you're near your computer, you can just go to KBOO.fm, and on the homepage there is the a deeper look showing our show today, and there you'll find links to be able to take direct action. But if you don't have a computer, you can just use your phone and call the president at the White House and tell him to close Guantanamo and end indefinite detention. When you do this on just any given day, it may not have as much impact, but today there are thousands of people taking action on behalf of really on behalf of our souls, but on behalf of the people at Guantanamo, and you can join them really easily. So the phone number for the White House is 202-456-1111. They have that number at the front desk here at KBOO if you decide to call because you haven't gotten it. And I'll give that number again, and it is on the web. Thank you, Pardis, for hanging by while I take the moment to ask people to take that action, because my background in this is coming out of being a post-World War II baby and growing up with hearing stories of Germans, knowing about horrors being done against Jewish people and doing nothing. Okay. And I grew up with the horror of that, the horror that regular people that we might know living next door, walking in grocery stores, would allow such horrible things to happen when they knew about them. And yet sometimes here in the United States, I feel like we're all being sort of forced into being good Germans if we don't really wake up and take some action. These are real people suffering really because of our government, and they're by and large, overwhelmingly innocent individuals in the sense that they were not at war with the United States or committing crimes when they were taken into custody. And that's been well proven. So I like the opportunity that we're given today to step out of that role of silence.
And I think that's exactly right. The silence, I think, is part of the problem here. You know, we at CCR and our partner organizations, we talk a lot about the responsibility of President Obama, and we talk a lot about the difficulties that Congress has set up. But Congress and the President have constituents, and they are the public. And the public needs to care. I think the public needs to learn about who is being held and what is being done in their name. And as one of the men I met with last week told me, you know, it's both the silence of the government and the silence of the people, of the public, that's killing us. So I think that it's incredibly important. It really starts with each person who's listening to this or reading about the hunger strike right now and feeling something, doing something based on that feeling, whether it's just finding out more about who's being held and, you know, getting more of the facts, calling the White House, joining a rally, pressuring your representative, whatever it is, doing something with that feeling.
And joint actions are always stronger. You know, when we join together, they can feel the weight of the people's voices. And so I really mean it when I encourage everybody to take some form of action today, even just, you know, go to the CCR, ccrjustice.org?
That's right.
And just go to that website and forward it to some friends, you know, or go on your Facebook and forward their Facebook page to some friends. Today, one action from you could stem a hundred other actions, and I thank you very much for that opportunity, Pardis. In talking about what's happening on the base, we know there is some force feeding going on, and we know that that's generally a violation of international law. I believe that the United Nations actually last week, the United Nations Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, appealed to the United States to close Guantanamo and talked a little bit about the hunger strike in that. Can you talk about the response of international organizations?
Yeah, it's been really encouraging. As you said, Navi Pillay, who's the High Commissioner for Human Rights at the UN, issued a very strong statement on April 5th, saying very clearly that the United States needs to close Guantanamo and that the continuing operation of the prison is in clear breach of international law. I think she also made a very important point about saying that the U.S. rightly criticizes other countries when they're in breach of their human rights obligations and their own commitments, but in order to do that effectively, it has to have its own credibility, and that credibility is really undermined by, you know, continuing to be in breach of its own commitments and its own promises. And Guantanamo is such an example of that. This is a prison that this administration recognizes should be closed and made that promise 4 years ago, and yet it still remains open. So there's a very strong statement from her. In that same week, there was a great statement by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is the human rights body with oversight over countries in the Americas and over the United States, also calling on the United States to close the prison, recognizing that the lack of certainty after this long, after more than a decade of detention, is a constant source of stress and anxiety and depression among detainees, and that there needs to be action and people need to start being transferred. So there is a certain momentum building. You know, our clients, the men at the base, are doing their part. They're protesting. They're trying to be heard. And I think it's on us to now help them be heard and do our part to keep the momentum going, because it's there. I think people are paying attention, again, a little bit more than we've seen in many years. I think Guantanamo really had become a forgotten problem for a long time, but it's visible again. The men there have made it visible again. They've made it relevant, and it's really our responsibility to do something about it now.
Now, I understand that there were some people calling for the International Red Cross to come in and address the critical situation and the force feeding, but that they have not responded to that. I've read some criticism of the International Red Cross's behavior with regard to the prison camp. Can you say anything about that?
I think the problem here is, one, it's about about transparency and just having independent monitors go in. The Red Cross is the only organization that the United States allows inside the base to actually communicate and have contact with men detained. There's no other independent organization, independent physicians, human rights organizations, UN people allowed in. And the problem by limiting monitoring to the Red Cross is that as a matter of policy, they don't make their findings public. So they go in and they may meet with people, and they were down at the base last week trying to verify what's going on. But we don't know about their findings. They share them with the government. They don't make them public. And that has been a continuing, I think, source of frustration for detainees because...
Are they never made public? Is this...
They're never made public. That's just a policy position of the Red Cross. And it's, you know, from their point of view, I think the confidentiality of their findings has been very important in allowing them to work with the U.S. government. So there is a reason for their policy. But on the flip side, when they're the only organization that's allowed in and no one else other than, you know, attorneys and the government... have any insight into what's going on, it becomes a problem.
Well, then they become complicit, it seems. You know, they become a partner in the secrecy.
Well, and I think there's a lot of frustration
by
our clients and by men at the base about the fact, you know, that they know what's going on and that it's just not being reported other than by the attorneys. And I think the hunger strike right now is a very good example of the problem here of not having other independent groups allowed to go down, because for 2 months now, much of the discussion had been about this sort of he said, she said game of, you know, how many people are actually on strike, how much food are they actually refusing, how much weight have they actually lost, how many people are being tube fed, and it shouldn't have to be that way. There should be, you know, reporters looking at this, journalists looking at this, the public wanting to know more should be able to have independent verification of our facts. You shouldn't have to rely on what I'm saying or what the military is saying. There should be a third independent way of finding out, and there really isn't that way. So that's part of the problem here.
Which also makes that indefinite detention so much more difficult for those there, because they know that word of what's happening to them is almost impossible to get out.
Right.
And so that's very frustrating, too, because they can, as an individual, take an action that never gets heard. And that is a very difficult situation for any human being to be in. Do we know if any of the men are nearing severe illness? I would think when you're getting up there, some of them have been on strike for quite a while, and some of them have been in hunger strikes earlier, so their overall condition has deteriorated as well. Do we know if any are in really, truly desperate straits?
There are. We do know that. We've heard from the attorneys for some men that they are in critical condition, and it lines up with medically what starts happening when people have been refusing food for this long. After day 40 of a hunger strike, you know, you start seeing things like loss of vision, loss of hearing, and the possibility of death, of cardiac arrest, and that's after day 40. We're talking now about over 60 days of a hunger strike. So for people who have been refusing food for that long, they are in critical condition. The irony is that, you know, the way that the government is saving life, they say, well, we're not going to let people die. We'll just force feed them. And that's been the response. You know, we're going to protect life.
And force feeding is extraordinarily brutal.
And I want to just describe that. I met with an individual who's a long-term hunger striker and is being force fed when I was there last week. And he described the procedure to me. And it's
go ahead
what
and tell
looks
us.
Like is being strapped into a chair at his ankles, his wrists, There's a strap around his waist and a strap around his shoulders. There's a tube inserted up his nose and down into his stomach. And there's liquid formula pumped in through the tube into his stomach for an hour. And he sits restrained with a tube up his nose and into his stomach being fed in that manner for an hour. Those for people who are being force-fed, that happens twice a day. They're fed twice a day. That's how the military says it's saving life at Guantanamo. That solution, quote unquote, is untenable. I mean, it at this point, if most of the people who are on hunger strike ultimately reach dangerously low body weights, they're going to have to be force-fed. And I think that the military has to know, that the administration has to know, that that isn't a tenable situation of having over 100 people being force-fed. The solution we need, I think there's a solution to the immediate crisis in terms of the searches of the Qurans in a way that can be resolved, but the solution more broadly has to be closure. It has to be closure. It has to be President Obama developing a plan to go with his promise, appointing someone within the administration to lead this effort forward, and resuming transfers.
Today we've got a few minutes left. A few minutes left, about 5 minutes left, and today is the day that there are demonstrations taking place all over the nation to ask for exactly what you're talking about, to support. I think if you've been listening out there, you have enough reason to know that there needs to be action to be taken on behalf of the hunger strikers and all of the men at Guantanamo. So can you tell us about, I know there's events in 20 cities, Washington, D.C., New York. Can you talk about the events today and what they're hoping to accomplish?
Sure. There are, as you said, there are rallies in New York and Times Square and in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco, on the West Coast, in the Midwest, on the East Coast, in the South. There's a list of cities on our website. If you go to ccrjustice.org, you'll see everywhere where there are actions planned. It's really to show the administration that there are people who still care. There are people who are concerned. There are people who would back him in fulfilling his promise. It's a way of getting the facts out about who's still there. I think for people who, you know, there are many people in the United States who probably don't, you know, even think Guantanamo is any longer a problem, probably think that most people were transferred. I've talked to some who said, well, wasn't it closed? Didn't President Obama say he was going to close it? So there's basic information that I think is still missing. And so it's in part to educate people about the facts and to let them know about this crisis right now, and to really impress on people that unless there's action taken, people will die. That's not an exaggeration. That's not, it's a fact.
We're not building this up. We're saying what's really happening.
There are people who've been refusing food for 65 days, and they can't be force-fed forever. There are 9 people who've already died. The last man who died at Guantanamo was last fall. His name was Adnan Latif. He's a Yemeni. He's a father. He's a husband. He had been twice cleared for transfer by the Bush and Obama administrations, and he died. So death is not unknown at Guantanamo, and it will happen again, and it should not take another person dying.
And, you know, there are actions also. You talked about Yemeni. There was an action at the American Embassy in Yemen, I believe, last week. People bringing a letter, supporters of the men there, asking for a solution, asking for them to be brought home. There's also been big actions in London, I believe. Mm-hmm. Asking for Guantanamo to be closed. There's still Shaker Amir, the last British citizen to be locked in Guantanamo. And I believe he is also one of the hunger strikers, though we don't get information about all who are. So today's actions join with really thousands of other people. So once again, I'm going to give the phone number for you who are out there in the audience and might want to call and make an action. It's 202-456-1111. Tell Obama to close Guantanamo. I did get one message that someone called and couldn't get through, and is there an email? Actually, if you go to ccr.org, on the page that talks about today, there is a place where you can just do an online statement. So you can click right on that and go to make an online statement. So thank you, caller who called in, our engineer, Rock, and got that message to us. Yeah, so if you get blocked up on the phone, there are other ways to take action, absolutely. Let's You know, we've got 2 minutes left, Pardis, and can you tell us, you know, how you plan to proceed from here, how you and the other organizations plan to proceed from today, taking the momentum of today?
You know, we are doing everything we can in different ways to keep the momentum going. We've organized a statement by human rights organizations to show that there's, you know, support in the human rights community and in the NGO community for this. We're trying to have meetings with the authorities. I think we really actually have to do everything and anything we can. There isn't time to waste. So we're really just trying to do everything, and we're trying to keep a line of communication with our clients to just keep information coming out about what's going on, because we really don't have a minute to lose. So we're doing everything we can.
And can they get information? That do they know that this is a day of action around the nation? And do they?
Some of them do. I was able to tell some of them. They get some limited news down there. They hear from the attorneys about what's going on. It has meant a great deal. I think it's been incredible, actually, for them to know that there are people outside, people in the United States, despite the inaction of their government, who are standing with them. There are some people who staged vigils, who fasted. Witness Against Torture is an amazing group that has held fasts and vigils for them. I think that's been incredible for them to hear about.
Well, thank you so much, Pardis Cabrillai of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We've been talking about the Guantanamo Day of Action to close Guantanamo and end indefinite detention. You can take action. Go to kboo.fm, look at A Deeper Look. You can follow the links there, or just go to ccrjustice.org and take action there. Thank you all for listening and for all of your activism out there.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11 this morning, about an hour from now, host Dan Johnson on Between the Covers will give you a chance to meet Portland icon Paula Nielsen, a.k.a. Sister Paula. She has a new book out titled Trans Evangelist, The Story of Her Life. She'll talk about her early life while still known as Larry, her years in Los Angeles, as well as the years she spent working at Darcel's 15 in Portland. And then at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still contribute at kboo.fm. Up next, it's an hour-long edition of Flashpoints.
On Flashpoints, Obama proposes cuts in Social Security benefits and increases to Medicare deductibles. We'll talk to radical economist Richard Wolff about the real impacts on the poor and working class. Also, we'll feature a mini teach-in on the multiple dangers of mass water fluoridation in the U.S. and Canada. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Coming up later on in this broadcast, we'll have a mini teach-in on the dangers of mass fluoridation. But first, we spoke with Professor Richard Wolff about the impact and dangers of the proposed cuts on Medicare and Social Security by President Obama. Listen to this.
My name is Richard Wolff. I'm a professor of economics at the New School University in New York City, and I run a project called democracyatwork.info, and you can access all of the analysis I do at rdwolf.com with two F's. My response to the news that President Obama is intending to redesign the measurement of Social Security payments, that is, the measurement of inflation each year that adjusts the Social Security payment, is a transparent and obvious effort to fundamentally lower the amount of money that the United States government is going to be giving people over 65 who are entitled to Social Security. It is therefore part of a classic austerity program, exactly the sort that has plunged unemployment in Europe, for example, to over 12% as of April 2013. They, too, have been raising taxes on their people, as we did with the payroll increase in January, and cutting the spending they give to their people, such as the Social Security cuts announced today. It is tragic. It is economically counterproductive. It represents a betrayal of the needs and desires of the American people who poured their money, their wages, into this Social Security fund over the years, a fund that was and remains way in the surplus, so there's no justification in terms of the funding of the Social Security system. But the worst thing of all about this is that moving to a chained calculation of the cost of living increase, which is what this is technically called, by giving less money to seniors, what this does is it makes the older people, after a lifetime of work contributing to the American economy, it makes those elderly who had no responsibility for bringing this crisis, who got none of the generous bailouts given to the big banks and corporations, it is now confronting them with paying the costs of a crisis they did not bring and of the bailouts they did not participate in. It is unjust, unfair, and the only reasonable response to the economics of what this government is doing in this compromise between Obama and the Congress, between Republicans and Democrats. The only legitimate response is shame on you.
Now, the Republicans still say, even in spite of this giveaway by Obama, that they're not going to fold when it comes to essentially a really expanded tax on the rich. Does that surprise you? On the one hand, the Republicans are holding strong and Obama seems to be caving?
No.